The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Getting the rules package actually done will be a challenge. And I think we should sort of take this entire episode right up through the late night drama on Friday as a reminder that, like, this was supposed to be the easy part. Like, this was supposed to be the part where Republicans picked a speaker and then they were going to have to, you know, try and figure out how to do things with a narrow majority. And this proved to be very difficult.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 9th, 2022. It's our first ever Choose Your Own Adventure podcast. I say that because it is Friday evening, and we still have no idea if Kevin McCarthy is going to be elected speaker tonight or not. So we figured you get to decide. We're going to record different options and, you know, we'll just piece it together. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio to do this game is Molly Reynolds, well known to Lawfare listeners. She is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, a senior editor at Lawfare, where she is, of course, bearer of the official title, Lawfare Congressional Guru. We talked about why it actually matters if you have a Speaker of the House, how long the House of Representatives can go without one before the government falls apart. We talked about what the consequences of the compromises Kevin McCarthy made, and we talked about, this is the part where you get to choose your adventure, what happens if he gets the votes tonight and what happens if he doesn't. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 9th. Burning Down the House with Molly Reynolds. Molly, we're recording at perhaps the least opportune moment to record on this subject, which is in the interregnum in which the House is adjourned on Friday afternoon. It is reconvening at 10 o'clock. We don't know what's going to happen when it does. We know that by the time anybody hears this, it will have either done something or prolonged the agony. Let's deal with the momentary situation right up front, get it out of the way, and then break through to higher ground in a fashion that will still be relevant Monday when anybody hears this. So for those who have been frozen in amber and buried in a cave, what is going on in the House of Representatives and what is the current state of play?
Sure. So the new House of Representatives, the House of Representatives for the 118th Congress, convened on Tuesday, the 3rd at noon, as it is constitutionally required to do. And basically the first order of business for a new House of Representatives is to select a speaker. I'm sure we'll talk about sort of the ways in which they can't really move on to other business and what that means without having first elected a speaker, but that's the way the chamber operates. And so beginning on Tuesday at about 1 o'clock, the House has been holding votes, 13 of them at this point, to select a speaker. no candidate has yet, as we are recording this, gotten enough votes to be elected speaker. We can kind of walk through the exact math, and that might make sense to do because kind of where we are right now is that Kevin McCarthy has made a substantial amount of progress. So there was a kind of anti-McCarthy faction of holdouts. It's been at about 20 members in kind of various combinations over the past several days. Between the votes yesterday on Thursday and the votes today, McCarthy made a substantial amount of headway with that faction, but he has not yet, again, as of this recording, made enough headway to actually have won the contest. It is about 5:30 p.m. The House, as you said, stands adjourned until 10 p.m. tonight. The broad expectation is that he is likely to kind of find a way between now and 10 p.m. to get the votes. Otherwise, they would not have adjourned until 10. They would have adjourned until some more civilized time, either tomorrow, Saturday, or perhaps through the full weekend. Part of why they are taking this time now is that there were two members of the House Republican Conference, both of whom were our pro McCarthy votes, who had to leave Washington, D.C. temporarily today, but they are expected to be back by 10 p.m. And so we will see whether, in fact, at that point, McCarthy has managed to make the math work such that he will get enough votes to be elected.
So putting ourselves in the shoes of the listener who wakes up Monday morning, immediately turns on the Lawfare podcast, it's fair to say that one of two things will have happened, or one of three things will have happened. Either Kevin McCarthy will have mustered the votes, and a few hours after we recorded this will be speaker and things will kind of go into hibernation for the weekend, or there will have been some other resolution at some point in the weekend, or the situation will be very much as it is now, which is to say a small number of holdouts are keeping on, and McCarthy remains in suspended animation.
I think that's right in regards certainly to the sort of most proximate question, which is the vote to be Speaker of the House. One of the immediate things that usually happens after the House has selected a speaker is that they move on to vote on what we refer to as the rules package. And this is always important. The rules package basically adopts the rules under which the House will operate for the next 2 years. It carries over most of the provisions from the previous Congress's rules, but it always makes amendments to those rules. And in this case, the amendments to the standing rules of the House that will be at stake, as well as some additional provisions, procedural provisions that will apply to just this Congress that are contained in that initial rules resolution. Those really represent some of the mechanisms by which the promises that Kevin McCarthy has made to various factions within the party as he's built his coalition to get elected speaker, that rules package really contains the mechanisms by which those promises or some of those promises are implemented. And so one thing at this stage of the game that I do expect to develop over the weekend, if McCarthy does get across the speaker finish line later tonight, is we'll get more detail about what exactly some of those promises that he's made look like. And how exactly are they being codified? Depending on the answers to those questions, it actually may be quite difficult for Republicans to get the votes for that rules package. So that would we would get to the point likely where the members of the 118th House of Representatives have been sworn in, but not necessarily terribly easily to a point where they can transact a lot of legislative business.
All right, so we will get to the rules question later in the conversation. Let's put a hold on it for now. I want to note that because this is not a political podcast, we're actually not going to talk about Kevin McCarthy's virtues or vices as a leader or anything like that, or Republicans or Democrats. I want to talk purely institutionally about the House and why this issue matters. And to start, I want to ask you, how long could you go without a Speaker of the House without the system falling apart. For example, eventually you would have a debt ceiling problem, right? Without a House of Representatives, you couldn't appropriate more money. The government would shut down. You couldn't brief the Gang of Eight on a national security matter because there's no eight. What's the realistic timeline? Like, if you do this for 3 days, it doesn't matter. It's just a political show. If you do it for 3 years, the civilization ends. What's the time curve of the problem look like?
So there are a couple different ways to answer this question. I think probably the first date at which people would start to really get quite frustrated about the speakership battle being protracted is actually a week from today, next Friday, the 13th. There is reporting that basically the Committee on House Administration, which is the committee within the House that has jurisdiction over like House operations, they have said that basically if the House is not organized by Friday, people who work for congressional committees cannot be paid. They will have had no resolution adopted that gives the committees authority to act in the 118th Congress. So folks would not be able to pay the people who work for them. We can sort of put aside the question about whether for some members of the Republican Conference, who have a certain orientation towards operations of the government, whether kind of throwing sand in the gears of government operations is in fact part of the point here. But that is that's the first date at which, you know, members of Congress would actually have to look at people who work for them and say, sorry, we haven't resolved this issue. We can't.
Okay, so that's actually sooner than I was expecting. I was thinking we had like 3 months before the situation got really dire.
It depends on sort of how dire you think that situation would be, but I think that's sort of one date. And then kind of moving beyond that, there is this issue of, you know, we, knock on wood, have not had a major disaster so far, natural or man-made, in the first week of 2023 so far. But it's certainly the case that if something did happen and Congress were to need to act quickly, where we are right now would be an obstacle to that kind of action.
Wait, let me just flesh that out. You mean that if Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, or, you know, Al-Qaeda blew up the World Trade Center, and you needed either a quick AUMF, which took a week, or an emergency appropriation, you would first have to, A, resolve this speaker issue, which presumably this would light a fire under people's ass to resolve. But secondly, you would have to do the routine business of organizing the House before you could go to. Is that right?
So I think there are a couple different ways you could do it technically, but you would need to do some things quickly, and you would most importantly need to muster a majority, a numerical majority to do that, depending on kind of what the circumstances were. Maybe we're talking about Republicans kind of getting their act together and doing it themselves. Maybe we're talking about some combination of Republicans and Democrats. It's hard to say exactly what would happen unless we knew what the situation was, but you would need to do something quickly to change where we are right now. If Congress did need to, say, pass a piece of legislation fast to respond to some sort of fast arising national crisis. The last thing I'll say in terms of kind of deadlines and dates that we know about, you mentioned the kind of two biggest ones, which are the date at which or by which Congress will need to act to address the debt limit. The best estimates we have is that that's sometime in the third quarter of this year. The other is the end of the government's fiscal year, so September 30th, after which there would be no discretionary appropriations to keep many federal operations going, and we would have a partial government shutdown. We could talk about whether we may in fact be headed for a partial government shutdown possibly anyway, based on some of the promises that McCarthy has apparently made. But those are kind of dates much farther in the future. But do, again, you know, you asked, could this go on forever without any consequence? The answer to that is definitely no.
All right. Let's go to a super basic question that I confess I don't know the answer to, which is, what is the Speaker of the House? I know that in a practical sense. I know the speaker is named in the Constitution, but the speaker's function, as I recall it, is not really defined in the Constitution. It's kind of incorporated as a matter of common law. So my question is, why does the House need a speaker in order to do any of its other business? And why couldn't the House members say, okay, we can't agree on a speaker, let's let the nice woman who seems to be presiding keep presiding for a while, and she's doing a perfectly able job of it, so she can keep presiding and we'll just, you know, vote on rules and stuff. What is the necessity of a Speaker of the House?
So I'll just start by saying that you are referencing Cheryl Johnson, who is the clerk of the House, who I want to say has been doing an admirable job.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I think she should be Speaker.
This week in a role that the clerk has not been asked to fill in 100 years. So there are sort of two ways to think about the Speaker of the House. So one, as you said, is as a constitutional officer. And in Article 1, Section 2, it says that the House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers. It's one of the things listed in Article 1, Section 2. And so in that sense, the Speaker of the House is actually unique among congressional leaders in that the office is provided for in the Constitution. Especially in modern times, the other core responsibility of the Speaker is to act as the leader of the majority party in the House of Representatives. So in this sense, the Speaker has sort of a dual constitutional and political role. The Speaker in that way is unique from the other three party leaders in Congress, so the minority leader in the House and the majority and minority leaders in the Senate, in that because the Speaker is provided for in the Constitution, the election or the selection of the Speaker is not, as we've seen very clearly this week, is not just a question of votes of the members of his or her own party. So part of kind of why we're in the situation that we're in is right now is because the Speaker has to get the support of a numerical majority of the members of the House voting for a candidate by name, as opposed to just a majority of the members of, in this case, the Republican Conference. That's why this situation, both procedurally and then also by extension politically and for the policy and process and for governance, is really different than, say, the question over, you know, who was going to be the Democratic leader in the House, or, you know, there was a kind of pro forma challenge to Mitch McConnell to be the Republican leader in the Senate. But that was ultimately a question for Senate Republicans and not a question for the entire U.S. Senate.
All right. And so explain to me why everyone agrees that no business can happen until the Speaker's chosen. So on the one hand, yeah, the Constitution says that the House shall choose its speaker, but it doesn't say that it should do it before it swears in the members, or that it can't do any other business until it does. And if there are no rules, because they haven't adopted a rules package, there doesn't seem to me to be any rule that says they can't choose rules and name committee heads before they choose a speaker. So why does everybody agree that the House is paralyzed until it does this?
So what I would say is the most accurate way to describe the situation is that under the House's current precedents and practices, the first thing that has to happen is that the Speaker is elected, and then the Speaker swears in the members, and then things can proceed from there. So what we are operating under now in the House, in the absence of rules for the 118th Congress, is what we call general parliamentary law. And that's what the clerk is enforcing from the chair. The House has ever operated under general parliamentary law for longer periods while there have been negotiations over the rules. So that is not necessarily an impediment to sort of basic legislative action or offering motions and that sort of thing. But because current House precedents and practices kind of lay out the steps as we're following them this week. It would be possible to change them, but you would need a majority to do so. And that's like the big thing to always remember about the House of Representatives is that in most cases, you could change the way the House works if you have a majority to do so. And as we've seen this week, in a range of contexts, you don't necessarily have Democrats for a whole range of reasons are not necessarily in the business this week of trying to make Republicans' lives easier. And so, you know, there were a couple of, for instance, proposals out there that one way to get out of this mess would be to adopt a resolution that would select the speaker by a plurality vote as opposed to by an absolute majority. That is something that could be done. It is something that has ever happened in American history that would require almost certainly some votes from Democrats because there would be very little incentive for some of these McCarthy holdouts to cooperate to make that change. So there are ways that we could probably operate differently, but right now the way that things are being run is just in accordance with the precedents of the House.
All right. So I want to go back to the issue that you raised earlier about the consequences of McCarthy's concessions for the operations of the House over the 2 years that this House is going to exist. I don't want to get into politics. We're a national security podcast after all. But some of these issues do bear on questions like whether the debt ceiling will be able to be lifted or raised, and whether the government will remain open, which do implicate some sort of core lawfare issues. So what are the relevant concessions that McCarthy has made that have implications for the things that we're concerned about?
Yeah, so I'm going to put three on the table, and I'm going to say that the exact nature of what the first two things I'm going to talk about will look like is a little bit in flux. So I'm going to talk in somewhat general terms. And then the third one, I think we have a little more clarity on. So the first involves a probable change in the composition of the House Rules Committee. So the way that the legislative process works in the House for most substantive pieces of legislation is that there's the bill itself. So let's call it H.R. 25. And that bill does whatever, funds the Defense Department, you know, is the National Defense Authorization Act, what have you. Before H.R. 25 is actually brought up for debate on the floor, the House first considers something called a special rule or a special order that governs debate on H.R. 25. And that resolution, that special rule says, you know, we're going to debate H.R. 25 for 2 hours, and the majority is going to control 1 hour, and the minority is going to control 1 hour. And here are the specific amendments that can be offered, that are in order to be offered to H.R. 25 on the floor. Here are some points of order that exist in the House rules that we're going to waive for consideration of H.R. 25. Maybe it's that it was not actually, the legislative text was not actually available for the amount of time before the vote that the House rules say. Those terms of debate, that resolution is written by something called the House Rules Committee. The House Rules Committee, the membership is stacked overwhelmingly in favor of the majority party. So for the last number of Congresses, it's had 13 members, 9 from the majority party, 4 from the minority party. One of the things that Kevin McCarthy has negotiated about is how many of those Republican seats on the Rules Committee would be held by members of the House Freedom Caucus, sort of House Freedom Caucus adjacent members, however you want to describe that faction in the Republican conference. And the sort of big bottom line here is that if the agreement is to put enough of those faction members on the Rules Committee, they would gain pretty significant leverage over what bills came to the floor of the House and the terms under which they would be debated. So let's imagine there is a supplemental appropriations bill to provide additional funding to the Ukrainians for the conduct of that conflict. if there is sufficient opposition in the Rules Committee among this Republican faction, and the Democrats on the Rules Committee also don't want to cooperate with the other Republicans on the Rules Committee, it could make it much harder to get that bill to the floor. There are some ways around it, but they're cumbersome and it would be difficult. So one piece is that basically it's likely that McCarthy will have ceded some, perhaps a significant amount of agenda control via the House Rules Committee to some of the folks in this kind of anti-McCarthy faction. So that's one thing. The second thing has to do with some concessions around discretionary spending. Again, there's some uncertainty about exactly what this would look like, but it appears that McCarthy has basically committed the House to potentially much lower levels of discretionary spending. Obviously, this ignores the existence of the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats, and there's a Democrat in the White House. So it's hard to say exactly how all of this would shake out. But it is clear that, the anti-McCarthy faction is really trying to drive down the amount of money that is spent on it through the discretionary appropriations process. One of the things that's unclear is whether this would be targeted principally at non-defense discretionary spending, if it would also be targeted at defense spending. So that's another place where there could be sort of far-reaching consequences of this deal that seems to be in progress. Related to that is that there are sort of agreements around what would be involved in bringing something to the floor to raise the debt limit. Again, it's not entirely clear exactly what's been agreed to, but suffice it to say, the goal of this anti-McCarthy faction is to make it much harder to do a clean increase to the debt limit, to simply raise the debt limit without some sort of concessions to do so. And then the last thing that I'll put on the table is basically the mechanism by which any of these commitments would be credibly kept to, and that's something called the motion to vacate the chair. The motion to vacate the chair is sort of roughly equivalent to a vote of no confidence in a parliamentary system. And it's basically the procedural avenue available to replace a Speaker of the House. It sort of came to prominence in 2015 when then Representative Mark Meadows threatened to use it to depose then Speaker John Boehner. Ultimately, John Boehner decided he was done being the Speaker of the House and resigned. But as a result of that 2015 episode, when Democrats took control of the chamber after the 2018 midterms, they made a change to the rules that basically made it harder for a rank and file member to offer a motion to vacate. They basically said that the motion would only be privileged on the floor if it was offered at the direction of one of the two party caucuses, so the Republican Conference or the Democratic Caucus. What is on the table now is the ability of any single member of the Republican Conference to offer a privileged motion to vacate. So basically, this would make it much easier for any member of the Republican Conference to move to try to get rid of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker if he did something, whether it was, work with Democrats to bring a clean debt limit increase to the floor or what have you. It would open up an easier avenue to try to replace him with someone else. It would ultimately, actually replacing him would require the cooperation of Democrats, and that you would need Democrats to also, vote against keeping McCarthy as Speaker. So I think there's an open question about whether Democrats in that situation would see McCarthy as sort of the lesser of several possible evils and go along with a set of steps to keep him in place. There was some talk of this in 2015 when there were threats of using the motion against Boehner. That's not a politically sustainable avenue for McCarthy over the medium term, but in sort of I could imagine in a world where we're kind of staring down, say, a debt limit crisis, that would be the sort of situation where Democrats go along with something for at least a short period of time. Again, it would not necessarily help McCarthy over a medium or long term. But that's kind of the third thing, the third major thing that has been negotiated about that I would say is of importance.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20. All right, so I want to ask, it is now 6 o'clock. In 4 hours, Kevin McCarthy wins his 14th vote and become Speaker. Given the concessions that you have just laid out, is that not the ultimate Pyrrhic victory? Because it seems to me what he's got is, first of all, he's got a rules committee packed with the people who tried to sack him, who are going to make it very difficult for him to move legislation that they don't like. He's got any one of them who can go after, you know, force him to go through this process again, should he do something like not bankrupting the United States with a debt limit increase. How do you possibly govern under these circumstances?
It's going to be very difficult. It's a Pyrrhic victory for, if it's what comes to pass, it's a Pyrrhic victory for McCarthy. Although I think one thing that's been pretty clear throughout this entire sort of episode is that Kevin McCarthy, you know, really wants to be Speaker of the House and is as a result, willing to do all kinds of negotiating to get to that point. But for, I think the people for whom it's an even bigger Pyrrhic victory are, other Republicans who, to be clear, you know, the House Republican Conference is very conservative, but there are folks in the conference who are, you know, not interested in having a debt limit crisis, are interested in continued aid to Ukraine, are interested in, say, increased funding for the Pentagon. Some of them are interested in getting earmarks for their districts, all kinds of kind of basic governance functions. And the deal that it seems like McCarthy has struck to get elected Speaker really makes achieving many of those other goals more difficult. And ultimately, I think it's anyone's guess if we're, you know, 6 months, 12 months from now, if McCarthy, if he's still the Speaker.
All right. So one option McCarthy, at least theoretically, had was to do business with the Democrats instead of doing business with the faction that opposed him. He did not do that. The Democrats don't seem to have offered him the option of doing that. But as I hear you talking, it sounds like, to me anyway, like eventually the wing of the Republican caucus in the House, which is to say, you know, a sizable majority of it that doesn't want to bankrupt the government, that doesn't want a debt limit crisis, does want to keep the government open and wants to continue supporting Ukraine, is kind of going to have to, may have to reconsider that. Is there a governance path that continues to think of the majority as the 222 Republicans, including the 20 who opposed McCarthy, or is the only realistic governance path to try to work with some group of Democrats?
This is what I would say, that the negotiations, as much as we know about them between McCarthy and the holdouts, have probably made the governance challenges worse. But it's not like the governance challenges weren't pretty big before Tuesday, principally because even the center of gravity in the House Republican Conference is pretty conservative. And Democrats control the Senate and the White House, and the Senate filibuster exists. And to get legislation done on things like raising the debt limit, like keeping the government open, like aid to Ukraine, in the current environment, you have Republicans in the House were going to have to work with Democrats. And probably in some cases, that was always going to mean that whoever was Speaker, whether it's Kevin McCarthy or otherwise, is going to have to go to Democrats to get the votes. This happened to John Boehner. This happened to Paul Ryan. I think where we have ended up, or where we seem to have ended up, is just in a spot where that's even harder to do And I think, so for me, one of the big questions going forward is whether any of the more pragmatically minded Republicans in the House are going to, on particular issues, whether it's the debt limit, whether it's Ukraine, start trying to make sort of issue by issue deals with elements of the Democratic caucus. Again, also thinking about the makeup of the Democratic caucus in the Senate and where the sort of distribution of Republican votes in the Senate. I think that's where I think we're going to end up seeing probably, you know, not a whole lot of legislating. But when we do see legislating, it'll be with kind of very specific coalitions.
And does that get around the rules issues that you just described by, you know, sort of if you have enough votes in the House, you can bypass the rules? Or is the theory that that somehow this coalition would manage to get through a rules committee of, you know, sort of stocked with refuseniks, sort of Republican dissenters, a reasonable rule for the debate of such hypothetical legislation?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple different ways it could happen. So one thing that we don't know is exactly the terms of the agreement that McCarthy is making about the composition of the Rules Committee. So it could be that the Freedom Caucus adjacent bloc pick some number of the folks over which they're negotiating, but McCarthy picks some. That's just really unclear. So some of it will come down ultimately to exactly who the Republicans are. I think in some situations, it's very unusual for the Democrats or whoever the minority party is on the Rules Committee to vote with members of the majority on reporting out a rule. But you know, in something like a debt ceiling crisis, I think you could probably, that's a possibility. And then there's also available in the House something called the discharge petition. It's a pretty clunky and cumbersome way to bring things to the floor.
But very fondly remembered by campaign finance reform.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that takes me back to some of my original portfolio at Brookings. But so it is possible basically to circumvent the Rules Committee by bringing something to the floor via the discharge petition.
And just for readers who are not either old enough to remember BCRA or who blotted it out from their memory, what is the discharge petition and how does it work?
So basically, it's a way to bring something to the floor if you get the signatures of a numerical majority of the House on a petition. So 218 members, and those members need not be only from the majority party. So it's something that we've seen used in the case of campaign finance and some other instances pretty occasionally, but where there is wide support within the minority party and then a split in the majority party, where only some members of the majority party want to do something. I think the most recent major discharge petition debates in the past decade or so have involved things like the Export-Import Bank, and there was some discharge petition action around immigration in recent years as well. And so you've seen a number of folks, particularly folks who are quite concerned about Republican hostage taking on the debt limit, say that what Democrats should start doing now is, you know, file a discharge petition and start gathering signatures on a discharge petition for a clean increase to the debt limit. I don't think that would be a terrible idea. But the fact that people are talking about that already on the fourth day of the Congress is, again, telling about where we are. And the, you know, Republicans have in the last decade shown a willingness to take the debt limit hostage. And so I do think, and obviously, as you mentioned, the debt limit has huge national security implications. It has huge global economic implications. And so I think we should take seriously the fact that where we appear to have landed after this speaker fight may require some pretty significant work to do something like raise the debt limit.
All right. So, Molly, let's consider two ends to this choose your own adventure story.
This is the worst choose your own adventure story I've ever read.
I'm going to ask you the question for the end of the podcast in which Kevin McCarthy is elected. And then I'm going to ask you the one for which we've still got this going on. We're going to run both of them, whichever happens. So, Molly, it's now 10:20, and Kevin McCarthy has won. He's going to be Speaker of the House What happens next?
First, I want to say that as a huge fan of the movie Clue, I love that I'm able to provide two alternate endings to this podcast. But in the case where Kevin McCarthy is elected,
we should start a Choose Your Own Adventure podcast that has you can go to minute 14:55 if you choose A.
That sounds like an editing nightmare for our fine podcast editor Jen. But to answer your question, I think if Kevin McCarthy is elected speaker tonight, I think I would expect that they would swear in the members quite quickly, but then we will really shift to this kind of debate over the rules package, codifying the promises that have been made, some of which I talked about, some of which I didn't, some of which we may not even know about at this point. And again, I think that may well be a heavy lift for Republicans to actually get adopted. I think in the world, I assume that the other scenario you want me to contemplate is Kevin McCarthy does not, in fact, make it across the finish line tonight.
Correct. Wait, let me ask that question. So, Molly, it's now 10:20. Kevin McCarthy has lost his 14th straight vote, and the House has adjourned for the weekend. What happens next?
Well, first I want to say it's not definite that they adjourn for the full weekend. If he loses at 10 tonight, they may well stay in through the weekend. Democrats have repeatedly been telling their own members that they should expect to stay in Washington until a speaker is elected, possibly through the weekend. But I think that then we really get to sort of two questions. One is there anything else that McCarthy could concede to enough of the remaining holdouts, however many that is, to get them to support him, or also to just simply not vote? That gets him part of the way to his needed numerical majority. And then the other would be whether at what point we move on to a different kind of consensus candidate. Obviously, McCarthy has really shied away from doing that. They drew this out for 4 days. And so I don't know if a loss at 10, which again, I think is the less likely option, but I don't know if a loss at 10 p.m. tonight would mean that. But I think obviously we've been in a relatively not unprecedented, but we haven't been in a moment like this for 100 years. So it's pretty hard to predict exactly how things will go.
Okay, Molly, it is now Sunday afternoon at 1:06 p.m. We have a stable situation, at least until listeners hear this, I think. What happened between our recording of the Choose Your Own Adventure? You don't get to choose your own adventure in the follow-up. What happened and what is happening as the weekend progresses?
Yeah, so basically, after we recorded on Friday around 5:30, we had, I would describe it as an adventure chosen for us by Matt Gaetz of Florida. So basically, the two scenarios that we really entertained when we recorded on Friday were that the House is scheduled to return at 10 p.m. on Friday night. We discussed the idea that they would take a vote, that either Mr. McCarthy would win or that Mr. McCarthy would lose. And if he lost, then we would sort of all go home for the weekend, probably regroup on Monday, and we would see what happened. Instead, where we ended up on Friday night at around a little after 10 p.m. was the House voted again on whether or not to elect Mr. McCarthy speaker. And that vote ended with basically mathematically McCarthy one half vote short of winning the numerical majority that he needed in order to be elected speaker. There were some moments of exceedingly high drama on the floor of the House, carried live on television for anyone who hates themselves enough to have been watching this after 10 p.m. on a Friday. I'll put myself in that category. You saw Mr. McCarthy sort of march down the aisle of the House to the House backbenches, discuss what was happening with Mr. Gaetz. There was a near, I don't want to say a near fist fight, but there was another member of the House Republican Conference who sort of lunged towards Mr. Gaetz in frustration.
Isn't it supposed to be called only when it happens on the floor of the House? Aren't we supposed to call them fisticuffs?
I mean, that we could certainly use that word, but
we so rarely get to. I feel like it's sort of an obligation.
Suppose I should say there were near fisticuffs on the floor of the House. And then ultimately, when it was clear that Mr. Gates was not going, or any of the other remaining holdouts against Mr. McCarthy, they were not going to change their vote on that particular vote, Patrick McHenry, Republican of North Carolina, got up, moved to adjourn the House until Monday, because they really had basically two options, which was vote again. At that point, they thought if they were going to vote again on the speaker's race, that McCarthy would lose again. So they were trying to buy themselves some time. And that adjournment vote got nearly all the way through the vote. It looked like it was going to fail. And then all of a sudden, I should say, it was very close as to whether it was going to fail or pass. And then all of a sudden, Mr. Gates and a number of other Republicans started changing their votes to say, no, we're not going to adjourn. And it's reported that Mr. Gates basically said to Mr. McCarthy, I'll vote for you now. Let's vote again. Exactly what happened to get, and now I should say, they voted down the adjournment resolution. They all came back. They voted again. Mr. Gates and a number of enough other Republican holdouts all voted present, which, as we talked about, listeners will recall from earlier in this podcast, basically lowers the number out of which McCarthy needed a numerical majority. Mr. McCarthy was elected speaker. He swore in the members of the House of Representatives, and then they all went home for the weekend and will return on Monday, and will at that point begin considering the rules package, which we discussed. And I think we can talk a little bit more about some emerging details about the agreement.
So let's do two things. First of all, what do we know about what caused Matt Gaetz to change his mind other than, you know, exhaustion? And then let's turn to what we know about the rules package.
Yeah. So to my mind, it's still a little unclear exactly what happened to get him to change his mind. There is reporting that suggests that President Trump was called and spoke to several of the members. There was also, I think, some sense that, you know, they went into the 10 p.m. vote with a level of confidence that was a little bit misplaced. They were more confident than they needed to be. But I do think that over the next several days, we'll learn more about this. And I think in terms of the rules package, we can talk about some changes that appear to have been made related to that may have helped get a number of the holdouts on board. I want to start by saying that we talked a fair amount earlier in this podcast about the rules package. That is something on which the House will actually vote. The reporting on what additional promises were made to various factions to get their support for McCarthy suggests that there have been a number of promises made that are not actually codified in a measure that the House will vote on. So
particularly like who's going to be on the Rules Committee.
Exactly. So the who those are, a lot of the, we talked some about sort of the conditions around a debt limit increase. And many of those promises are not codified in the rules package. The biggest one that again we discussed was this is the change in the number of members needed to offer a motion to vacate the chair. So that's the way one would replace Speaker McCarthy. There is some emerging reporting about some changes that were made to a provision that would establish a select subcommittee of the House Committee on the Judiciary to investigate, quote, the weaponization of government. So obviously, as listeners of this podcast know, House Republicans in particular have criticized the FBI and other federal law enforcement entities for what they see as overreach into the lives of ordinary Americans, in some case, overreach into, you know, investigating members of Congress and, you know, things related to January 6th. And so even the kind of initial versions of the rules package that were released had a provision for this select subcommittee. It appears that over the course of the week, exactly kind of who was promised this when is less clear to me. But at some point over the course of the week, the kind of authorities of that select subcommittee were expanded a little bit to include sort of more possible topics of investigation that had than what had been in the original resolution that would create the select subcommittee. One thing that some members were pushing for that does not appear to have happened is that some members wanted this select subcommittee to actually be a full select committee as opposed to a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. By having it as a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee, it would Jim Jordan of Ohio, who's slated to be the chair of the Judiciary Committee, would retain a fair amount of influence over its direction, particularly around the issuance of subpoenas. And there were some members who sort of wanted it to stand on its own. It does seem there's reporting that promises were made around staffing and funding for the committee, the select subcommittee, allegedly sort of roughly on par with the January 6th committee. Exactly what all of this looks like and what this translates to in practice is really remains to be seen. But it does seem like some of that there may have been some changes to some of these things around kind of Republicans trying to use the tools of the House of Representatives to conduct really aggressive oversight on some of the things about, again, particularly the FBI that they've been critical of, that may have played a role in kind of bringing this to a conclusion. The other thing I'll say about Mr. Gates in particular is that at various points he had asked for a subcommittee chairmanship on the Armed Services Committee. It's unclear if that was something given to him as a in exchange for his agreeing to vote present. We just don't, on this and so many other things, we will just have to watch and see kind of where this all goes. And the last thing I'll say about the rules package is that one of the things that we talked about earlier in the podcast is the degree to which, you know, the rules package, even though it doesn't codify all of the promises made, it codifies some of them, and that it's not necessarily clear that it's going to get uniform support from Republicans. There's at least one Republican from Texas who came out on Friday and said that he would not be supporting the rules package. And again, because Republicans have such a narrow majority, they have a 5-seat majority, I don't know how probable, but it's certainly possible that getting the rules package actually done will be a challenge. And I think we should sort of take this entire episode right up through the late night drama on Friday as a reminder that like this was supposed to be the easy part. Like this was supposed to be the part where Republicans picked a speaker and then they were going to have to, you know, try and figure out how to do things with a narrow majority. And this proved to be very difficult.
All right. Well, we will come back to you if there is a deep dive to do on the rules package, or if we have round two of, I don't know what we call this episode, but if we have round two of it over the rules package and the House proves unable to organize itself, having proven for a week unable to choose a speaker, Molly Reynolds, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and never more so than when the guest is a Brookings Senior Fellow. Our audio engineer this episode is Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Our publicity director is you, the listener, so get on it, tweet about the Lawfare Podcast, share us on Facebook. I haven't seen enough TikTok videos about the Lawfare Podcast, so y'all get on that and join our Patreon at patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by the great Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the one, the only, the Taipei-based Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.